Jerry is a record-breaking mountaineer who has taken on challenges such as K2. Jerry lives with diabetes and has a mantra of not letting diabetes stop him in his life and achieving his goals, whether that being doing the Alps or Himalayas. Jerry is an inspirational after co-founding Action for Diabetes with one of his friends. Jerry has embarked on many challenges to help support those less fortunate in medical care, supporting children and young people from Southeast Asia. Jerry has fundraised over £500,000 from all his adventures in mountain climbing, with over 680 young people supported, and an astonishing 2.6 million blood test monitors have been provided to help support those living with diabetes and limited access to care. And we'll be talking about that later on. His work has been extremely valuable in the support of those living with diabetes and has helped shape and change attitudes towards diabetes, helping to advocate for the community, and demonstrates that diabetes should not impact the lives of people living with diabetes. As well as this, Jerry has faced some hardship in his life, which I'm sure he'll share tonight. And Jerry is known for his inspirational speaking and ability to command the audience. He has been recognized by Eton College and many other places. Jerry has broken his neck on two occasions during his mountaineering. He has also been struck by lightning, and he has also been in an avalanche in minus 30 degrees. Jerry was diagnosed with type 1 in 2001. Jerry has proved time and time again that diabetes does not stop him doing what he wants. Despite being told that his climbing days were over when he was diagnosed, Jerry has continued climbing and does not let his chronic health condition affect his active outdoor life, stop him having fun with his friends and family, or slow down the development of his business. Tonight, welcome to the Diabetes Chat, Jerry.
Thank you.
What an amazing introduction there, and I must thank Gary for helping put that together. I think that really that is outstanding. And tonight, there's some very interesting things in there that we'll definitely talk about. And if anyone has any questions, you can hashtag Diabetes Chat, or you can request a microphone and come ask the question to Jerry himself. So Jerry, obviously I sent you a message earlier on today. We're going to start with some just quick fire questions. So just sort of like quick sort of answers really, rather than going into it, because later on we'll go into more detail about things. And then we're going to talk a little bit about who you are and your sort of adventures and expeditions, and then the lead up of you being diagnosed with diabetes. We'll talk about your diagnostic, your journey with diabetes, and also the sort of how you've basically carried on with fulfilling an active and physical lifestyle when told you wouldn't. And then we'll talk about the amazing Action for Diabetes, which you launched in 2015. So lots to get through over the next hour or so. Let's start, shall we, with our quick fire questions. What is your name and occupation?
So my name's Jerry Gore, and I'm a manager, motivational speaker. I run an academy, co-founder of a charity, and I guide people on big hills. Various revenue streams, I guess.
Brilliant. When were you diagnosed with diabetes, and how old were you?
So my memory is rubbish, but I remember this date, 31st December 2001. I was 40 years old. I'd just come up for my 40th birthday, so it's a great birthday present. And I was diagnosed, I got all the symptoms, got the whole thing over and done with in 4 days. Five days.
Wow. Do you finger prick or use smart technology like Flash CGM?
Both, because I use the Abbott Freestyle Libre, and I find it's not great. Mm-hmm. And so I use finger pricks definitely, but I use CGM also as well.
Brilliant. With your finger pricking, do you change your lancets every day?
No.
Do you use insulin pens or pump? What do you prefer if you've used both?
I've used both and I prefer pens.
Why?
Because basically I don't like the tubing, I don't like the occlusions, I don't like the thing going wrong. I don't like it because it doesn't work well at altitude. I don't find it's durable, and I just prefer the freedom of pens. I'm a freedom lover, and I find a pump just restricts me and my freedom to operate and do stuff and travel and live a free life.
That's fair enough, isn't it? Are you hyper aware?
Yeah.
What symptoms do you have of hypos, Jerry?
So my hands start shaking a bit, I sweat, and energy starts draining from my body, mostly my arms, especially when I'm climbing or cycling, from my legs. I just start feeling a bit weird, a bit muzzy. And the symptoms are relatively easy to describe in terms of a hypo. In terms of a hypo, when blood sugars are too high, there, mm-hmm. I find it really hard to describe that. But I feel that as well, definitely.
So what's your typical go-to hypo treatments?
I try to get, if I'm close to it, a teaspoonful of honey. If not that, orange juice. If not that, Coca-Cola. If not that, a lion bar, which isn't great, but I'm normally exercising at the time, so I prefer something to get me up and keep me up rather than just to fix the hypo.
Yeah. You've already mentioned hypo. What do you think's worse for you, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
Definitely hypos, and I have a lot of them, and I'm not proud of that. And I tried to have a good A1C. It's about 6.8 on average. But every single day of my life is different. And when I say different, literally, mm-hmm. one day I could be running up a mountain. The next day I could be in front of a screen. Next day I can be on a plane. The next day I can be sat at an all-day conference just eating. You know, so there's a lot of up and downs. And so to keep me, keep relatively good sugar control, I inject a lot. And mm-hmm. and sometimes that was in hypos.
Yeah. One thing you like about diabetes, Jerry, and one thing you don't like about diabetes?
I love what I love about diabetes is introduced me to a whole range of new people across the globe, and I love that. It's a whole world I never would have met before. The thing I hate about diabetes is every minute of every hour of every day constantly thinking sugar.
Yeah, absolutely get that 100%. Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
Can hardly smell it.
Fair play. Here's a fun one. We always ask to finish our quick round of questions. And it might be quite applicable to you. It says, if you're on a desert island, what three things would you take? And we're going to say now, you can have all your diabetes equipment. So you got your finger prick test, you got your pens, you got whatever you need, your lion bars, whatever. But it's interesting for you, for someone who is very active and has done things like K2 and all the amazing expeditions you've done, what three things do you like take with you? Do you have any special items that you like to take?
I would say insulin pen, test strips, and lion bars.
If you had all them there, because I'm a nice guy, what other things would you like to take?
I'd like to take about 10 gigabyte of podcasts. I'm really into podcasts. I'm rubbish at reading. I love listening to podcasts. And I feel a massive gap in my brain in terms of knowledge about so many things, and his, you know, books about social history. I'd like to hear, you know, books about that, podcasts, Audible, things like that. Other than that, pretty happy, really. Maybe a pull-up bar.
There we go. So there you go, guys. A little insight into Jerry. So what we're going to do is I'm going to crack on and I'm going to get to know you a little bit more. I've got some questions. And yeah, you've got me tonight, Jerry. So I'm hosting tonight. Before we talk a little bit about going to sort of your diabetes and your diagnostic, your journey, mm-hmm. and how that you carried on with your expeditions and all your amazing things, is pre-diabetes. Can you maybe just give us a little background to you? Who are you, Jerry? Like, I've just read some notes that I've seen from Gary. You're at 16. You were, was it traveling the Iceland ice caps at 17? Mont Blanc at 19, looking at the 75 class of peaks. And then you were also in the Royal Marines as an officer. So please just give us a little insight of who you are, Jerry, and what you've done.
Okay, well, I'm just a bloke, really. Two legs, two arms, and a small brain. I'm an adventurer, I suppose. I'm lots of different things, but I'm an adventurer. I like adventure, and I like exploration, and I like learning and doing stuff. So when I was 10 years old, I went on a John Ridgway School of Adventure course at the top of Scotland. Most of the people on the course were 16 or older. I was 10. Wow. And I remember leaving home, going on a train all the way up to right at the top of Scotland, and just abseiling off cliffs and climbing up mountains and running with people who are much better than me, and sailing and canoeing and doing a lot of outdoor stuff and just loving it. My first expedition was when I was 16, 1977. I crossed the southeast ice cap of Iceland. That was really amazing. It's a 5-week expedition. And then I kind of got into it from there. I started building it up. I'm a great believer in little steps. And so, you don't get into living on a vertical wall of rock in a hanging tent. You don't do that straight off. You build it up bit by bit. Yeah. So, hiking, mountaineering, glacier travel. Then I did Mont Blanc when I was 17. It's a little bit of altitude, 4,800 meters. When I was 19, I went to California first to do some work, get some money, and then I was going to join a guy up in the Northwest Territories of Canada to build a log cabin and photograph wildlife, and then to kayak out down the Mackenzie River, the dangerous river, and we're going to build this kind of log raft and kayak down. And it all sounded brilliant. I was up for it. I went to San Francisco, and I was actually working in Sausalito, which is just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And I was working various shops, cleaning, and I got a job as a cook, having never cooked anything more than about scrambled eggs. But I kind of charmed my way in, and actually all I was really after was a bloody cleaning job. But I had a word with the guy who's Austrian, and he kind of liked my accent, and he thought I was quite funny, and he said, yeah, great, well, if you can cook, come on in. So the first day, we're in this I'm in this buffet bar, and there's a flat griddle, so it's like a frying pan, but it's a huge piece of metal and it's completely flat. And this massive guy came in, because we were right next to a bodybuilding club, and this massive guy came in and he said, okay, Mac, I'll have a 16-ounce hash browns, over easies, and a rack of toast. And I go, very good, sir. And what would you like to eat? I had no idea what he was talking about. But I must have got through like about 24 eggs, trying to, fry eggs one side and fry them over, But luckily the guy who owned the buffet bar, he liked me, and he took me around and we went sailing and I got to know him and his family. And then I was, you know, just weekends, I was hitchhiking around and I hitched over across the Golden Gate Bridge to this kind of like park full of rocks. And there was all these guys, massive muscles, and they were doing these incredible moves called bouldering. When you're only like 1 or 2 feet off the ground, you don't need a rope or anything, but you're doing very technical, very hard roots. And I just thought this was like ballet dancing on rock. I thought it was amazing. So wow. I was saying, oh wow, you know, where do you, you know, I mean, how do you get into this? And they go, well, man, it all starts in the valley. And I go, so what, you know, what's the valley? And they go, you don't know what the valley is? I go, well, you know, like, what's the valley? And they go, Yosemite. And I kind of, in the back of my mind, had this idea that Yosemite was a national park, but I didn't really know about it. And the guy said, well, you know, if you're keen, we'll pick you up Friday night. We'll be the other end of the bridge, and we'll take you to the valley, and we'll do a bit of climbing, right? And I hadn't really done much technical climbing. So anyway, I stuffed into the back of this Datsun pickup. And we were driving through the night. And it was getting cold. And I only had a T-shirt on. And, you know, we're obviously gaining height. And when you were kind of getting into the mountains, but I couldn't really see anything. And then, you know, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. The driver just said, okay, P-brake. You know, we all got out. And the guy said, hey, I want to show you something. And I was a bit worried, you know, it's just like these big hairy males. And anyway, so he took me round the corner of the road. And there, by the light of a full moon, I saw the southwest face of El Capitan, 1,300 vertical meters in front of me. So, I mean, that's like, sorry, not 1,300, 1,000 vertical meters of rock. So, you know, that's like a kilometer in front of you vertically. So you look up vertically 1,000 meters. And I was just, it was love at first sight. And I thought, yeah, I need to do some playing here. So anyway, we went into Yosemite Valley. We did some climbing. I fell in love with the whole big wall thing. And that's like living on these vertical walls in these hanging tents. And that was kind of the start of my apprenticeship. Then I had to get up to Canada, because it was the start of meeting up with my mate Chris, and we're going to go and build this log cabin and all the rest of it. So I packed in my job, you know, cooking burgers, because I was never very good at it, and I take this plane up to Calgary. And I meet this guy, you know, Chris, who we're going to go and set up this log cabin. And we're in Waterton Lake, southern Alberta. So this is western side of Canada. And it's spring. And we're kind of doing some reconnaissance. We're doing a little bit of treks in the snow, getting to know each other. And it's all going, you know, pretty badly, because Chris and I just didn't get on. Ooh, sorry, there's a lot of feedback on the line. Is that okay?
Hello. Okay.
Yeah, and anyway, kind of like halfway through this kind of training period, Chris goes, well, really, Jerry, I can't take you up into the Northwest Territories, so you're going to have to find something else to do this year, because I can't do it, and I can't afford to bring you up there, and it's not going to work. And so I was kind of left abandoned in spring, 20 years old, or 19 and a half, without a partner, with no money, and with one contact. And the one contact was the secretary of the Canadian Alpine Club, who I just found. And I phoned up this secretary and I said, well, you know, I'm a climber. I pretended I was a climber. I wasn't really. I'm a climber. And, you know, are there any climbers looking for partners? And, you know, I'm here for the summer and I'd like to climb in the Rockies and blah, blah, blah. And this lady is really kind. She said, well, there's this guy called Jim Comfort, and he's got some sort of project going on in Banff. You know, Banff's like the capital of the Canadian Rockies. So I phoned this guy up, and Jim said, yeah, well, great. Come on up, and we'll give you a trial. And I'm thinking, trial for what? Anyway, I met this guy, and he picked me up, and he basically explained that he was running a thing called the Alberta Rockies Mountaineering Society, and the aim was to climb the 75 classic peaks of the Canadian Rockies, because This was 1980. That's the 75th anniversary since Alberta became an official province of Canada. And to celebrate it, the Alberta government was giving away lots of money. And Jim had picked up on this, and he wanted to climb the 75 classic peaks, and he needed a climbing project manager. In steps Jerry Gore. So I go, I'll be up for that. I mean, I might be only sort of 19 and a half, but, you know, I'm up for a bit of adventure. Show me where my sleeping bag is. And anyway, he literally sort of kicked me out. He gave me a team, and I ran the whole project, and I just climbed all summer, and we did all the 75 classic peaks. I met Princess Margaret, met a bunch of people, big lots of VIP trips. It was just an amazing start to my sort of climbing career. I then went back to the UK. I joined the Royal Marines. I did a short service commission as an officer in the Royal Marines. I got my Green Beret. I got Commandant General's Commendation, Best Royal Marine in 1983 for saving some Norwegians in Arctic Norway. And then I finished my commission, and I went to Loughborough, did a degree in exercise physiology. I then joined Field and Trek, because I was into marketing, and I was a marketing manager. That didn't work out, so I managed to get a job in Cotswold, just as working in the shops. This is like 1990, and I got on really well with the owners, Tony Ingham and Charles Barwell. And they made me the shop manager for the new shop in Bettercoed, Cotswold Outdoor, which is actually rock bottom because they built a bigger one. But anyway, I set up the shop there. I got all these amazing climbers to work for me, like, you know, people like Tim Emmett and Andy Kirkpatrick and all these guys. And a really good scene. And then I was invited down to the head office in the Cotswolds. I became the marketing director. And then I sort of developed the company and marketing and outdoor industry by taking, you know, the outdoor industry to the clothes show and getting Gore-Tex on, you know, in sort of as a high street fashion thing. And that all went well. And then, sadly, at the end of the 90s, I was made redundant, and then I was left kind of bereft. I had a young family, two girls under seven. I didn't have a job, and on top of that, I was diagnosed type 1 diabetic.
What a journey. What an impressive journey. Like, you've had and experienced and the culture, and it's just absolutely fascinating. So you then say you were diagnosed with diabetes in 2001, right? So please share with us a little bit about that then, your diagnostic. Like, what symptoms did you have when you were diagnosed with diabetes? Have you got any sort of early stories you'd like to share? Like, how long you were in hospital for? And how did you feel like at that time you were diagnosed? And how was it for you and your family? Very challenging. And then also for them to say, hey, your climbing days may be over. Like, how did you feel? Lots of questions there, Jerry. I'll throw that back straight at you.
I'll try to remember all of those. I probably should answer. You probably really worked out. So I was full of self-doubt. You know, I'd done pretty well as a marketing director at Cotswold, but then I'd been made redundant, and I was getting marketing consultancy jobs, but, you know, 6 month jobs, and it wasn't really my. I was based in the Cotswolds, which I don't know if you've been there, but it's a lot of sheep and a lot of antique shops. It's not my sort of place. I'm kind of looking for what I'm going to do with my life. And you know, I'm a hard worker, and I thought, okay, well, I need to get requalified. I need to get, you know, up-to-date marketing diploma. And even though I'd done a degree in it years ago, you know, marketing moves on a lot. This is, you know, dot-com boom, early, you know, 2000s. So I start an intensive 5-week 5-weekend course doing a marketing diploma at Maidenhead with the Chartered Institute of Marketing. And boy, was it intensive, because the first weekend they worked us really hard. So I'm like 40 and the rest are like, you know, late 20s, early 30s, really clever young people, keen to get on the ladder, on the corporate ladder. And they worked as hard, working till 2 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, same on Saturday, Sunday morning. And then about 11 o'clock Sunday morning, having worked pretty much nonstop for 2 days and two nights, they sprung an exam question on us. And I hadn't answered exam questions for years, you know, for like age 40. And there was this shock. I could remember, because I always do my best. I try my best, and I really try to answer the questions and what have you. But I've got various learning difficulties, and I just panicked, and I just tried so hard to write the right answer over it was a 2-hour exam. And anyway, we finished that weekend. I get in the car. I'm driving back on the M4 from Maidenhead down to the Cotswolds. And it's a rainy night, and the people rushing home, you know, they want to get home to get to bed to start the week, and you know, the next day. And you know, it's just a kind of rainy, drizzly, grey, you know, motorway environment. And these cars are passing me, and there's rain splashing on the windscreen. I'm just in my own world of kind of worry and self-doubt, and I felt so tired. And then I just kind of went blind. I looked at the license plate in front of me, and I couldn't focus. I just couldn't see the license plate of the car in front of me. It's just gone all fuzzy and grey, like I'm in this fog. And I look out at these drivers passing me, and they're just a blur. And I kind of thought, well, it's you know, they're just going fast, and obviously it's going to be a blur. And then I realised everything was a blur.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know it then, but my sugars were really high. I was at like 30 millimoles of sugar, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. So anyway, I slowed right down, and I managed to creep home on the back roads, got home just desperate to talk to my wife, Jackie, who is ex-paramedic. And I get in, and the kids were already in bed, so I couldn't say goodnight to them. And I'm just feeling awful and drained and knackered. And Jackie says, well, so, you know, you're obviously in a bad shape. Well, give me some symptoms. And I said, well, you know, I'm really thirsty. I'm just drinking gallons. I've got no energy. And I've got this kind of weird, like, fungal infection. But the worst thing is I can't see. Everything's a blur. And she literally, I mean, Jackie is an amazing person, as you'll kind of get to know. But she kind of just went, sounds like diabetes to me. And I go, well, what the hell is that? I just had no idea.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you know, it's this thing to do with your pancreas and insulin. And, you know, I mean, I think by then she'd actually dried up in terms of her knowledge of type 1 diabetes. But she said, what you need is a blood test. Yeah. So tomorrow morning, you're going to go to the surgery and you're going to blood test. And she kind of drilled it into me. So the next day I go along to see my doctor, and I'm not going to say any names because it gets people into trouble. You know, I saw my doctor, and he's a GP, and he's a climber as well. And, you know, we go climbing walls together and stuff. He's a lovely guy. And I tell him everything, and he goes, Jerry, come on. You're not diabetic. You've been overdoing it like you always do. Take a week off work. Wow. And you're, and literally he said that. This is 2001.
And you literally walked out that door.
No, I didn't. Because I said to him, well, listen, mate, I'm not going to say his first name. I've got to be honest. And he looked at me, and I looked at him with my deep stare. And I said, I am more frightened of my wife than I am of you. Yeah. I need a blood test. And he could see I was shaking. Well, otherwise, honestly, I would have walked out. Because he said that was it. You know, I don't need anything. I just need to relax and take a week off work. So anyway, that was a Monday. On the Wednesday, I went to the clinic. I got a blood test, and that was in the morning. And then Wednesday afternoon, remember it very well, I got one of those calls. And it was from a nurse. It was a very nice practice nurse. And she said, hi, Mr. O'Brien Gore, blah, blah, blah. We've tested your blood, your 30 millimoles of sugar. We think you're type 1 diabetic. Please come in this afternoon for your first injection.
Wow.
And pretty much that was it. And so I went down to the clinic. I met this lovely nurse who, you know, sort of explained the whole thing about type 1 diabetes in 10 minutes, because that's what they allowed them in those days. She showed me how to lift a, you know, bit of flesh and stick a needle in it. And she gave me a little vial of a Mixtard, you know, a combination of slow and fast acting insulin. Yeah. And she said, well, inject that twice a day. Let's keep in touch and see how you get on. And I'm not really exaggerating that, but that was pretty much it.
Wow.
And she goes, so have you got any questions? I go, well, yeah, I'm kind of really worried because, you know, I picked up this magazine and, you know, there's this picture, and I showed this picture, and this was before she'd actually showed me the syringe to stick in my leg. And I showed her this double spread, paid spread of this young boy sticking a big needle in his stomach. And I go, God, you know, I mean, is that what I've got to do? And she said, no, sorry. And she picked up the magazine. This was in the waiting room at the clinic, right? She picked it up and she goes, oh, no, sorry, no, it's 5 years out of date. That's an old one. No, the needles are much smaller now.
But that was scary, right?
It was scary. Oh, my. It was a big bloody needle. So anyway, she got me onto small syringes and, you know, I was injecting. And I remember, because it's me, you know, it's the way I am. I'm a team player. One of the first things I said to this lady was, well, who else has got this condition? And it just felt so obvious to me. I need to talk to other people who share this condition. And pretty much from that day, I've been, maybe obsessed isn't the right word, but very, very interested in learning and talking to, spending time with other type 1 diabetics. Because that's how you learn, right? But I didn't know anything condition, but it just seems so obvious. You learn from the people who've got this thing, right? Yeah. Anyway, she put me in touch with a few people, and that led to a breakthrough, which was she put me in touch. Well, I eventually got hold of a lady called Nikki Wallace. Now, with Nikki Wallace in 2000 had set up a thing called Mountains for Active Diabetes, and you can find MAD on Facebook. They've got, you know, a Facebook page. And so this is all outdoor people who are living with type 1 diabetes, and they're all climbers, walkers, skiers, whatever. And the first kind of meet was up in North Wales 3 or 4 months after I got diagnosed. I went up to Plaza Brenin in North Wales, and there's a whole bunch of us. And I remember it was so brilliant. We all went to a restaurant for an evening meal, and there's, you know, the restaurant's full of people, and we all start injecting, getting out our needles and syringes and stuff. And I'm sure the people around us thought, well, this must be a bloody drug pushers convention or something. But it was brilliant because it just normalized. You know, it normalizes the and it was so good because, you know, you kind of think, yeah, you're not alone, and actually you can talk to people, and yeah, there's a guy there from Canada, there's a guy there from Chile, there's a guy there from Germany, and we were all sharing, you know, stories, and it was brilliant, and that was the start of my kind of journey to get into peer-to-peer support, because I just think it's one of the secrets, you know.
Sure.
And it sort of developed from there.
So from my notes, what I read, were you worried at the time thinking, so you've had this active physical lifestyle where you've been literally all over the world, and that could stop? Like, were you worrying that you might not be able to do these amazing expeditions? And what did you do?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this guy, I'm not going to name, I'm turning him out to be a villain. He's not a villain. He's a lovely guy. But, you know, he's a healthcare professional, and he tells you what he's trained and knows, you know, and he's also a climber. And so he knows what I do, and when I do a new route. So just to get it into people's understanding, when you go and say, I don't know, let's say you go and climb Mount Everest, you join a team, and you have a jumar, which is a clamp, and there's rope, and it starts from base camp and it goes all the way to the summit. You put that clamp on the rope and you keep pushing that clamp up the rope, and that's how you get to the top. So you're using this as mechanical assistance, but you don't put the rope there, you don't find the route up the mountain. You don't do any reconnaissance. You just follow the rope. And it's a little bit like a journey in a taxi or in a journey where you drive the car. When you're doing a commercial expedition, or, you know, you're not opening new routes, it's like being a passenger in a taxi. And I don't want to take anything away from anybody. I'm just telling you how it is. On a new route expedition, you're the driver. You have to organize all the equipment. You've got to put the team together. You've got to sort out your food, the logistics, everything. And then you go to a place like Baffin Island, which is Arctic Canada, where you won't see anybody for 6 weeks. And the only things you will see are polar bears. Or you go to remote Pakistan or remote Nepalese Himalaya. There's no one around, just you and your team and your equipment, and you're responsible totally for yourself. There's no helicopter backup, there's no radio, there's nothing. You put the rope on the mountain, you find the route on the mountain, and it's up to you whether you get to the top or not. And I'm not saying it's safe at all. I've lost 19 friends to climbing over the years, but it's you know, it's a totally different thing. And so I was, you know, getting back to Mike and this doctor, he knew what I did, and he said, well, you know, Jerry, you can probably do some small climbs, but your new route expedition stuff, I'm sorry, but you're kind of going to have to forget that. And in a way, he was saying, you can't climb anymore, because that's all the climbing I knew. I didn't do small little climbs. I went on 6 week to 2 month, 3 month expedition. And that's what I did. And he was saying, you can't do that anymore. And so, you know, this was all kind of getting to me. And I was thinking, well, you know, is my life going to really stop with this condition? And I learned, like I've said before, like baby steps. And so I'd went out climbing like rocks. The first time I actually rock climbed since after my diagnosis was in Avon Gorge. I was climbing a route, Yellow Edge, with a mate of mine called Chris, another Chris. I climbed. And you don't need to know the details, because it's an extreme climb. So you're hanging off your fingertips and you're putting little pieces of metal the size of your thumbnail into cracks, and that's your protection. So if you fall, those little bits of metal will hopefully arrest your fall. And I'm climbing up, I'm literally hanging on by my fingertips on stuff I'm normally really comfortable with, and then the hypo kicked in. Wow. And I feel the blood literally draining out of my fingers, draining out of my forearms, draining out of my biceps, and I'm going, I don't think I can hold on any longer. And I knew that I was looking at a ground fall, so probably, you know, maybe 15 meters straight onto the deck, and it's going to hurt, right? And so I shout down to Chris, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, just watch me. I'm ready. And, you know, he's a climber, right? So Chris is going, yeah, okay, man, I've got you, you know, no worries. But he didn't realize that, you know, I was literally losing my strength. I mean, like, it was happening in front of me. And I managed to get one of those little pieces of metal into a crack, and it took me like, I'm going to say 20 minutes. Probably in reality, it was 10 minutes, but I spent my life trying to get this little piece of metal into this tiny crack. And then I was going to just fall, and hopefully the little bit of metal would hold. And I kept saying to Chris, shouting down, Chris, watch me. In other words, you know, hold the rope, get ready for this fall. And then I just slumped, because every single ounce of energy had gone into placing that piece of protection. Luckily it held, and then in no time Chris lowered me to the floor. I was safe, I didn't break anything. And Chris goes, well, you better lose some lard, mate. In other words, you better lose some weight, which is a typical climber's, you know, reference to, well, you know, if you can't climb it, it's because, you know, you're too heavy, you've got too much body fat. And he didn't know what's going on, I didn't know what was going on, but well, I learned in it was subsequent, you know, learning about the condition. That was my first proper hypo, and ever since then, I've always carried, you know, a little chocolate bar or Twix bars in my chalk bag. Always carry, and I never go anywhere without a gel or a bar or whatever. Yeah. But you know, I learn by doing, and I learn, you know, little bit by little bit. And so, you know, I got into rock climbing. I was learning how to deal with my condition as a rock climber. And it was all going, it was all starting to go pretty well. But I'm going to have to cut this bit short because it's a long story. But the bottom line is, we found Jackie and I were looking for a different chapter in our lives. We've been in the Cotswolds some time. I lost my job there, so there wasn't really a reason to stay in the Cotswolds. Our kids were still pretty young, mm-hmm. and we found this chalet amazingly in the southern French Alps. There's a whole story right there, but in simplicity, the day I saw Valoise, where I now live, the day I was about to hand over the money for this chalet was the day I actually saw Valoise for the first time. I actually saw the chalet where I live now for the first time. So it was a big leap of faith, but it went really well. Jack is really supportive, and there's a whole story I can tell there, but I'm not going to. Bottom line is, we moved the family out, and my whole thing was, would I be able to live my sort of fast-paced, you know, climbing and marketing and work existence, mm-hmm. as a type one, living in the Southern Alps, yeah. in a country where I hardly spoke any of the same language, and Jackie didn't, so we, you know, neither of us were really French speakers. And on top of all of that, of course, we got two young kids, and on top of all that, I didn't know anything about the French health system. But I got to say, 20 years on, it was brilliant.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about, so when you are doing these amazing expeditions, K2, you've done Jerry's Insulin Challenges, you've done the Insulin 360 expedition. So when you're doing these sort of things or training, what sort of diabetes kit would you have on with you? I've seen a picture, a video on your website where you literally, like you say, you're hanging off cliff edges and you're literally checking your levels or you're injecting. I just love it. But sort of what sort of kit do you have on you, like, immediately? And are you on, did you say, Libre now?
I've got the Freestyle Libre.
Yes. How does that help in terms of, like, has it changed your sort of life now, where you can, like, you can have the notifications flashing up and you can hear it and you can see the arrows trending? Is that by far more beneficial to you, and you can maybe prevent them hypos earlier and just crack on?
Well, again, so much to say on that question, but the bottom line is, some good, some bad. Yeah. The good are, honestly, the alarms, because I was having, in the, you know, about 7 or 8 years into living in France, I was having really bad nighttime hypos, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning. Jackie, my wife, wakes up because the bed's covered in sweat, and yeah. her lovely husband is literally this graunching, grinching, horrible, monstrous thing that's gritting my teeth and screaming. She's got videos of it, and I can show these videos. They are horrible. And I'm like this monster. And what she's then got to do is, very gently, very quietly, introduce a little bit of honey into my mouth, into my gums, get a little bit of sugar in there. Then, and this takes like 30 minutes, and I'm thrashing around. Then she introduces a little honey sandwich into my mouth, and that gets my blood sugars up to a stage where I'm sort of compass mentis. Then she leads me into the bathroom. I have a shower. She has a shower. We strip the bed. We put new bed sheets on it. And I go straight back to sleep because I'm knackered and I've had a huge hypo and blah, blah, blah. And I can sleep. You know, I've always been able to do that. But it's like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning and she's awake, and her day had already started at 2. And at one stage in my diabetic career, I was having one of those bad nighttime hypos a week. And that was really bad news for her, bad news for me, bad news for our kids. And it wasn't great. And that's what made me go onto the pump. And that helped a little bit and get better control. And then eventually, you know, I got CGM, and the CGM has helped me a lot because it's got these alarms, which I've only discovered in the last year, actually. And the alarms are brilliant, especially the low alarm. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, each day is so different, because I'm doing so much variation, eating, food, exercise, the whole thing. I do have, you know, ups and downs, and the alarms are great for that. And especially the alarm that the hypo alarm. So, you know, it'll wake me up in the middle of the night and it tells me I'm low, and then I, you know, eat something and then I'm okay. But before the alarms, before the CGM, it wasn't great. And so the CGM's definitely helped me, but the bad news about CGM is I'm very trigger happy. I just am, and I hate it, but I just am. As soon as I see the blood sugar shooting up, I'm banging in insulin, and it's not great, and I'm not proud of it, and I tried to control it, but, you know, I'm a normal human being.
It's you doing you. There's no set way, and you can do whatever you feel best to do, and of course, I'm sure you speak to your teams and stuff. But you can, I can see the huge impact of the technology, how it's not only helped you but also your family, your wife. That's huge. So what about with sort of physical activity, bringing it back before we talk about action for diabetes? Let's bring it back to sort of exercise and your expeditions. And I know not long ago when we last spoke, you were doing a cycle event and stuff. Like, how does the technology help with that? Like because I guess, like you say, you can set the alarms that at the level you want to, and you can hopefully prevent it, I guess, much sooner.
Well, let me first of all tell you some of the things I've learned, mm-hmm. and that, you know, that my kind of philosophy to this condition. The first thing I've learned and I believe in is adapt your diabetes to your life and not your life to your diabetes. Mm-hmm. My whole thing about diabetes is it's all about motivation. You can have, you know, you can do everything perfectly, but if you're so fed up and depressed, and I know a lot of type 1s like that, you know, I know type 1s who won't even go to a restaurant because they're just so worried about what food they're going to get served and whether they're going to hypo, that, you know, they stop having good control. And that happened to a friend of mine. She got really demotivated in her teens, like she's 18, and she wanted to be the same as everybody, and she stopped testing and she wasn't motivated, and by 25 she was registered blind. So, you know, I know it can be bad, and I know for me motivation is the most important thing, and it's about adapting my diabetes to my lifestyle. And I love climbing, I like, you know, sport. But the other thing I've learned about diabetes is exercise, and I can't explain the physiology, and I've asked lots of endocrinologists this, but exercise works, but it's got to be a minimum of 30 minutes of exercise a day, exercise that increases your heart rate, and that really helps me control my blood sugar. So every day I will try and do at least 30 minutes of, you know, fairly, not hugely, but fairly intensive heart and training. Nothing, you know, like running 100 meters or sprinting up a mountain, but, you know, something that will increase my heart rate, and that will really help me, not that day, but the day after. So exercise, I learned very quickly, was very important for me, and I found it was really beneficial. And so moving to the Alps, where I get 300 days of sunshine, the widest range of outdoor sports anywhere in Europe. I mean, it's brilliant for every single sport you can think, from road cycling to mountain biking to skiing to ice climbing, everything. That really helped me control my condition, because I was doing regular, fun, adventurous sport outdoors. And when I'm outdoors, when I'm climbing or skiing or whatever I'm doing, I can feel my insulin sensitivity is so much better. And so, you know, everybody goes, well, how can you do all this climbing stuff? And the reality is, I don't get hypos when I'm on a mountain. I get hypos when I sit in front of the computer, because I stop thinking about my diabetes. I stop, you know, thinking, or can't feel all the signs so readily as when I'm outdoors doing something active. That's why it's kind of beneficial, if anything, to do exercise. And that's why I do a lot of it, partly because I love it, but partly because it's good for my condition. Does that answer the question?
sure does. thank you so much. So what we'll do now, Jerry, is I've got about 10, 15 minutes. So let's talk about action for diabetes. And if you can just sort of briefly give a sort of overview of what action for diabetes is, because people that are listening now, or when they listen back on our podcast or YouTube, they might not know what action for diabetes is. But how was the charity set up? Why was it set up? When was it set up? And Just yeah, tell us a little bit about what Action for Diabetes is.
So 2006 was my tipping point. I've been trying to climb the hardest extreme mountain climb on each of the seven continents, and the hardest big wall climb in Africa was Andrininka Park in southern Madagascar. So I'm down in southern Madagascar. We've got this 900 meter vertical wall with a team of pro climbers. They're really brilliant, and we open this route on this big, very steep, very hard, very technical, literally finger edge climbing, and we do that. And the end of the trip, we're in southern Madagascar, and our guide's helping us, took us to this local market, and it was just an eye opener. Now, I've been in quite a few poor countries in my life, but you know, I went to this market and I met this lady, and on her little tarpaulin, she had like four tomatoes, one cucumber, and a couple of onions, and she was hoping to sell that for, then, this is 2006, about $1.50 to maybe $2, and those $2 would feed her and her four children for the following week until the next market.
Is he gone?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, can I hear you?
Can you hear me? Yeah,
I can hear you, Tom, but not Jerry.
Oh, you can't. Hold it.
I can hear Jerry.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? No.
Yeah, I can hear you, Jerry.
Yeah. Mark, maybe jump out and come back in, hopefully. Go on.
Yeah. Okay.
Go on, Jerry. Sorry.
And I was talking to our guide, and I was saying, well, you know, I mean, how do people survive here? And he goes, oh, you know, everybody's really happy. And there's lots of stories I can tell you about Madagascar. It's an amazing country. The people are amazing. But I started asking about, well, you know, where's the nearest clinic? Do you have a hospital? And anyway, my research basically led me to the overwhelming conclusion that if a young person got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, that would definitely be a death sentence. There's no way they'd survive.
Yeah.
And then I started doing the research and realizing that a lot of people in the world have no access to the sort of medical facilities and support that you would need in the event of a T1D diagnosis. And then I started raising money for Insulin for Life, and we're distributing money, or distributing insulin all around the world to, you know, crisis areas and you know, areas where there was real need. And that was the time, this is like 2012, when my one of my oldest friends, Charles Toomey, we were in the Royal Marines together. He was he did officer training with me. He contacted me. He was living in Thailand, Southeast Asia, and he'd been living there for years. He left the Royal Marines, ex-special forces, sort of on a brilliant man. But he got into logistics and the pharmaceutical industry, and his first job was in Lilly, so he knew all about diabetes and insulin. And he said, well, Jerry, I've been tracking you, I've seen watching you doing your expeditions, and you know, I'm really impressed with what you're doing, and you know, I've got a lot of experience of diabetes, and I think there's a huge need here. Because my whole thing was helping, you know, children and young people, impoverished young people with type 1 diabetes. And he said, well, you know, the knowledge and the healthcare across Southeast Asia regarding type 1 diabetes is really poor. And he knew this because of his research. I mean, okay, a quick story about Charles. He was the CEO of a business, a logistics supplier, DKSH, which when he joined it was turning over 500 million. In less than 10 years, he turned that into 4.5 billion turnovers. So he knew all about big numbers, medication, money, and he had a great network. And he said, yeah, I think we can really do a good job and really make an impact. And that was kind of really the start of Action for Diabetes. Because, you know, basically type 1 diabetes is fatal if it's untreated, and So then and even now, disadvantaged children in Southeast Asia, you know, suffer because of their limited access to just basic healthcare. And we're trying to change that. That's exactly what Action for Diabetes is trying to do. It's a UK registered charity. It's dedicated to giving health and hope to disadvantaged young people with type 1 diabetes. It's focused on Southeast Asia because that's where Charles is. That's where his network is. And we basically have three main programs. We have a clinic support program. So, you know, we give out life-saving medical care to disadvantaged young people. We give them access to basic healthcare. And I mean, to date, we've given out 64,000 insulin cartridges. We've enabled something like 2.6, 2.7 million blood glucose test strips, yeah. More than 6,000 HbA1c tests, and, you know, provided continual T1D support to more than 700 children across six countries. We're in Vietnam, Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia, Malaysia, and Laos. And I'm really excited to say that by the end of this year, we would have reached our 1,000 child target. So we'll be looking after and supporting and caring for more than 1,000 children across the region. We also do a healthcare professional support program. So we do A4D webinars. We've got a T1D network or series of network meetings. And we also sponsor young doctors. And then the third thing that we do is we do education and type 1 education and awareness. So we do the education thing, which is essential for everybody. Carers, patients, and HCPs. We do that through Hello Type 1. Hello Type 1 is a pure play online educational platform. We launched in July 2020. It's available in English, Khmer, which is the language they speak in Cambodia, Vietnamese, Thai, and just literally last week we launched in Malaysia and the language of Melayu. M-E-L-A-Y-U, I believe. So that's the Malaysian language. And we plan to roll that out across all of the countries where we're operational. We do diabetes family camps, and we've also got an Aspire program. And this is like a scholarship program for further education and training for young people with type 1 diabetes. So I guess in a nutshell, that's Action for Diabetes. I've got to say, pretty excited because we've just received a Helmsley grant for $650,000. So now we can operate in the Philippines and grow our clinics and save more lives.
That's incredible, honestly, Jerry. Like, wow. It's breathtaking, and I love all the different programs that you guys have got. Not only are you helping people that who are living with diabetes, but you're also helping educate the healthcare professionals. You're educating people, the families, and support as well. I love the family camps as well. Can you just tell me a little bit about the family camps? I'm quite interested in that.
Well, these are the things I love. I mean, I really love these because this is back to the peer-to-peer support. Yeah. But before I say it, can I just say, this is not about me and it's not about Charlie. This is about a team of people who are absolutely passionate about saving lives. And we're so lucky to have really good people. It's never one person or two people. It's always a team effort. So it's really important to say. But yeah, so our A4D diabetes family camps, we operate them in five different countries. And we basically, they're anything between a one-day camp and a four-day camp. And it just depends on the area and the money available and the country as well, because I can't say the name of the country, but you can probably guess. Some of the countries where we operate, it's pretty brutal in terms of the conditions and the camp downs and all the rest of it. And I can't say the name of the country I'm talking about, but you know what I'm talking about. Sure. And we run these camps, and I get very much involved. And we take these kids, and we take the carers, and we bring on healthcare professionals and people who know what they're talking about. So nutritionists are really important. People who can play games and encourage children to learn by having fun. That's the best way. and not make it, you know, education through fear. This is education through inspiration, and that is such an important message. And so, you know, we're not giving these kids lots of numbers and putting the fear of God into them. We're going, you know, it's okay, you know, you can live with this condition. It doesn't matter if you get it wrong. You've always got to try your best, but, you know, let's have some fun, let's play some games, let's do some stuff. And we have lots of, you know, children friendly games, a lot of you know, arts and crafts stuff. We do tigger tag, we do all sorts of different stuff, but it's active and it's outdoor and it's fun, and it's obviously all in local language. We have a lot of, you know, translators and stuff. And we try to, you know, motivate the kids. That's really important, but the kids are pretty motivated anyway. But the people we really work hard on are the carers. So these are often the parents. Sometimes it can be an older sibling, because, I mean, I can tell you some stories, but just a quick one. There's a wife, mother, with a six-year-old child in the middle of the jungles in Cambodia. She was living under plastic, alone, frightened, with no money, because her husband, partner, had kicked her out of the family along with her child. He had to look after the four other children in his family, and he kicked her out because basically he couldn't afford any health care for this ailing, sick child who obviously had type 1 diabetes. So you can imagine, you know, we talk about problems in this country. Yeah. There's a woman living in the plastic with nothing, no hope, no insulin, nothing, and her kid is falling apart, dying.
It's a death sentence, isn't it?
It's absolutely just, and so when these kids come to us, you know, we have to be really careful and not just, you know, just jump around and say everything's great, because in many cases it's not. You have to really help them and get their confidence and encouragement, you know. But it's so amazing,
you obviously talked about what you've used and what we use here in the UK, for instance, but what sort of technology are they using over there in Southeast Asia? Are they blood machines? Is it syringes? Is it pens? What? Please tell us a little bit about it. It's interesting to hear.
It's super basic. We would love to give them pumps, pens, and CGMs. We can't give them any of that. All we can do is give them Mixtard, so that's, you know, a mix of basal and bolus. We give them syringes, and we give them 4 strips a day to test. So get their own glucometer, and these glucometers, more and more, not in every country we operate, but more and more, are Bluetooth. So we can get some of the, we can do some telemedicine and get some of the results and analysis back to the healthcare professionals who can live up to 700 kilometers away from where the, you know, the actual child is. And we measure everything, because Charlie, like I said, he's been in that part of the world for years, and fraud is rife. And so we are really careful to measure every drop of insulin we give out, every test strip, everything. And now we're doing a lot of research, and we're publishing papers, and we're presenting them, you know, at like conferences like European Society of Pediatric Endocrinology, ISPAD. We're starting, because we're the first people in countries like Laos. I mean, before we got into Laos and started saving lives in 2015, there weren't any diabetics, because they're all dead. I mean, it sounds horrible, but it's true. And so, you know, we're publishing papers now. We're monitoring. We always record stuff. That's Charlie's background. We've got a great team of people who do that. But to get back to your question is, yeah, they literally have the basic injectable insulin, you know. So these are cartridges full of Mixtard with syringes. Some patients in some clinics in some countries, they're on basal bolus. We could never afford like a Freestyle Libre CGM, unless there's any great donors out there listening. And we can't afford pumps. Of course we'd like to get there. Of course we want to give them the best that we have here. But, you know, when I talk to some of the people who work for us in places like Thailand or Cambodia, and I go, yeah, well, you know, we've got closed loop systems and they're free on the NHS and any kid can get them in Britain, they just roll their eyes and go, I wish.
yeah, absolutely. But honestly, what you are doing to them people, you are giving hope, and you are providing the support for them. So it's incredible everything that the team of Action for Diabetes is doing, and just keep it up, really. And it's amazing all the programs that you're doing. And thank you so much. That's That's great. So honestly, Jerry, tonight's been really, really fascinating. Just like sitting back and just like listening to you share your stories with us, and making it very personal as well, like talking about how diabetes impacted you with home life, with your wife Jackie, with your two children, your two girls, and how it's sort of changed when you moved over to a different country, and I think finishing talking about Action for Diabetes, it was really, really fascinating. Just to finish, really, is how can people check out more information for Action for Diabetes, or check out all the adventures that you've been on? How can people support Action for Diabetes in sort of donating or fundraising, like, or getting involved or checking out more? What can people do?
Well, the first thing is I'm going to mention two websites. The first one is action4diabetes.org. So that's our main website, and it's pretty easy to find. A4D stands for action4diabetes.org, and you'll find all the contacts and details there. You can reach out to me there. My own personal website is jerrygore.com. That's jerrygore.com. Very simple, all together. jerrygore.com, no spaces. And again, all my contact details are there. I've got more. Every year I do an insulin challenge to raise money for Action for Diabetes, and you know, you've all the list of all my expeditions, all my JICs, Jerry Insulin Challenges, they're all on my website. So if you want more, it's all there. And I've got to give a quick plug. My book is coming out. My Life as a Type 1 Diabetic is coming out, and it'll be hopefully out this autumn. So I'll give you a shout when that comes out.
Absolutely, and we'll have to get you back to do some sort of quick sort of overview of the book, and then people can go check it out. Will the money sort of go towards Action for Diabetes, or you're not sure at this stage of?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still working with the publishers, but at least 10% of the book money will go A4D. It's pretty complex with publishing these days, but yeah, at least 10% is going to go there, because you know, that's why I've written the book, to basically tell people about the charity, to tell people about, you know, make people more aware about this condition, and also just to, you know, break down some of the barriers. I mean, I talk to a lot of healthcare professionals all around the world, and you know, I think they're amazing people, and we all have to work together, but the word is together. And my vision for type 1 diabetes care is when on the team, the diabetes team, you've got a psychologist, you've got a nutritionist, you've got a healthcare professional who specializes in diabetes, and you've also got a patient expert. And yes, the patient expert is someone like you or me who we've been, you know, trained or done some schooling with the NHS, and we've got the doctor's trust, and we're there to help and advise and support and give peer-to-peer. And that would be the most amazing type 1 diabetes team. Yes. And I really, that's one of my big sort of missions is to help everybody be aware of the importance of working with type 1 diabetes, because you know, the people who know so much about this condition is the people who live with it every minute of every day, and that's us.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just to finish then, Jerry, it's just been such a fantastic, interesting chat tonight, Claire. But thank you, Jerry, for a really interesting evening. Richard has said, so interesting tonight, incredible stuff, your inspiration. So it's just been really, really cool. I really enjoyed it. I love hanging out with you when we did our Zoom a couple of months ago. I feel it's just been very cultured tonight. I feel like I've been on a roadmap of different parts of the world, and I've really found it interesting how diabetes is in different parts of the world. But maybe just to finish, Jerry, what advice would you give to anyone that is listening now or listens back, or just in general? I know you're a inspirational speaker. Like, what advice would you give to someone, whether it's a parent or a carer or someone living with diabetes, whatever age or background, what advice would you give them?
I think the first thing I would say is learn a bit more about your condition every single day so you become your own doctor. I would say that with no fear of contradiction. I'm not trying to dish any healthcare professional. They're absolutely brilliant. But I think we have a responsibility to learn about our own condition. And there's a lot of books, a lot of webinars, a lot of information out there to really understand it so we become our own doctors and so we can manage our blood sugars, because it's up to us. And obviously, when you're a carer for a young child, you know, that's very difficult. But I say to young mothers and I say to young fathers, you know, very, very or quicker than you would normally as a parent, you've got to let your children become responsible for their condition. So children learn by doing. Give them stuff to do and get them to start understanding their own condition. And I think, honestly, and people will tell me apart for this, I think that can start as young as 5 or 6. You know, we underestimate children, and they're incredible people. And we need to empower them, and we need to give them the tools so they can fly like little birds. I'm getting emotional now.
I love it. Honestly, it's been great chatting to you tonight, Jerry. We'll definitely catch up another time and hear more about the book and stuff when that comes out. But guys, go back, listen back, and check out all the amazing things that Jerry is doing on his own adventures, but also the amazing stuff that the Action for Diabetes team are doing. Thank you, Jerry, for tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.